this week, the Kinoteka Film Festival has rolled into town. The three-week event celebrates Polish film, and as part of this year's proceedings, they've put together a retrospective of work by Jerzy Skolimowski. On today's Monocle Arts Review, I'll be discussing the director with Tim Roby, film critic for The Telegraph. Elsewhere on the program, we'll also be taking a look at the brand new live-action, well, somewhat live-action, Jungle Book film and the manga-inspired Japanese movie Our Little Sister. That's all ahead on the Monocle Arts Review. Stay tuned. Tim Roby, welcome to the show. Now, last week, the 14th edition of the Polish Film Festival Kinoteka kicked off here in London. The annual event is organised by the Polish Cultural Institute and celebrates the best in the country's cinema. Now, this year, Kinoteka has focused on the work of the storied film director Jerzy Skolimowski, who opened the festival with his new film, 11 Minutes. Tim, perhaps fill us in on the work of Skolimowski.
He's a really indefatigable figure, actually. The most interesting thing about him, in a way, is that he spent a lot of his career working in England. So despite being a Polish native, and now he's gone back to Poland to make more films there, for a good couple of decades, he was working here and producing some of the most interesting films of the 70s and 80s in the UK. Perhaps his best-known film is Deep End from the late 70s, which is about the relationship between a teenage boy in Soho and an older woman. But there are other revelations that this festival has been able to dig up for us, because so much of his work is actually really not readily available. It's never been widely issued on DVD or Blu-ray.
It's the sort of funny sort of thing, isn't it, these days, where you think that with so many different ways to watch movies, DVDs, Blu-rays, streaming from all sorts of platforms, films should be more available than ever. And yet, so often, such as we're talking about here, films just slip through the cracks. If they don't make it to DVD, it's sort of like they cease to exist.
That's absolutely right, yeah. I mean, an event like this is a good chance to highlight someone's work, not only and give you a chance to see these films in their full glory on the big screen, but actually perhaps to prompt discussion about them that might encourage DVD labels to take a punt on them. One of his great films, which I saw the other day for the first time, is a film called Moonlighting from 1982, starring Jeremy Irons, which is absolutely fascinating. Irons plays the only English-speaking member of a group of Polish builders who have flown over to the UK to work in very kind of short order and for absolutely no money on this flat that they're doing up somewhere in West London. And Irons is the foreman, having to kind of wheel and deal and negotiate his way through this process, while his sort of subordinates just have to get on with the kind of mind-numbing daily grind of doing it all while sleeping there, and doing it all while basically being fed on gruel and having absolutely no money. It's incredibly sort of desperate in terms of the sort of circumstances of the film, but also incredibly funny, incredibly great, really great bit of filmmaking, I thought.
Well, we've got a bit of a clip of 1982's Moonlighting. Let's have a listen.
But by sending workmen over from Poland and paying our wages and zlotys, our boss can have his London house done for a quarter of what he would have to pay a British builder.
People like a bit of peace and quiet! That's better. Almost acceptable.
Tim, I suppose for many people, watching a film like this, because it's been revived by a festival, it might be the first time that they're really being let into the work of Skolimowski. Do you think that a film like Moonlighting will potentially be enough to really draw a whole generation of new fans into the work of the director?
I would say so. I'd say it's a perfect place to start with him, actually. It's so elegantly structured, this film, because they arrive, the first shot we see is an airport announcer saying that the plane is landing. They arrive, they go straight to this house where they have to kind of deposit all of their equipment, and it's already a building site, it's a complete shambles. We're spending the rest of the film there, essentially, bar Jeremy Irons' occasional trips out to the supermarket to try and wheedle his way into getting enough food for them to live on. And he finds a trick that he resorts to time and again over the course of the film, of kind of buying a bunch of food, keeping the receipt, hiding the food around the corner, and then going back into the shop and pretending he's left something there, gathering all the same items again into a bag and saying, no, I've bought these already, and showing them the receipt, and thereby getting away with kind of four times the amount of vegetables that he'd actually paid for, because they're so desperate and working so close to the breadline. But it's all about ingenuity, and it's about the kind of stamina of these characters and their survival, really. It's very cleverly structured, and yeah, that's what we get. We just get the house gradually being kind of made habitable and all of their efforts in doing that. And it's such a good London film as well. The sort of details from the era ring so true, the kind of misspelled shop signs and all these kind of animals wandering around on the streets. And just the kind of texture of it is so vivid. It feels, I mean, there's great sequences here, which he must have taken, you know, 10, 12 goes at. There's a scene where they order a skip, which arrives, and it's overfilled because all the other neighbours, of course, in classic British style, have been dumping all of their own rubbish into the skip overnight. And the collectors come and refuse to take all the items, and they're throwing stuff back onto the skip, and it's falling off, and they're throwing it again, and this time it's landing. Really great choreographed sequences like that. I think it's one of his fortes.
Well, Kinoteca continues until the 28th of April. Head to kinoteca.org.uk for tickets and details. Now, almost 50 years since the release of the Disney animation, a new live-action version of The Jungle Book is rolling out across screens across the world. The story, originally written by Rudyard Kipling, follows the adventures of Mowgli, a young boy who is brought up by wolves in the jungle. Now, Tim, most people will know the jazz-fueled Disney film from their childhood. If you loved the first film, will you enjoy this one?
I suspect you will, because I think it's very well put together. The film has to negotiate the issue of whether it's going to kind of remake the Disney version or not, because it sort of doesn't quite want to go there. It only does two of the songs, for instance. And some would say that even doing two of the songs is a bit strange. It does Bare Necessities and I Want to Be Like You. Mm. And it's a bit odd because they kind of come from nowhere in the sense that we're otherwise doing a fairly straight retelling of the Kipling story. But they sort of can't ignore the Disney version because it's so iconic. The characters of Baloo and all the other characters are so identifiable that, you know, the songs just kind of come with the territory. So they do it. I think the real draw of this version for new audiences is actually sort of technological, if you like. It's the incredible skill and detail that has gone into actually making the animals feel as real as possible.
It's interesting, I think, because we call it a live-action version, but really it's not, is it? I mean, it is an animation really all the way through. We've got the real actor playing the role of Mowgli, but then everything else is CGI. But I say that and I sort of sound like I'm talking about Transformers or Batman v Superman, but it's not that kind of CGI at all. It's absolutely sublime to look at.
It really is, yeah. And I mean, I guess there are some real backgrounds in there, but they're digitally enhanced. And yes, of course, all the other characters, the animal characters, are CGI. But really, really state-of-the-art CGI. I mean, I think they save orangutan characters till quite late in the film for good reason, because he is the absolute kind of pièce de résistance of sitting on that massive throne, surrounded by monkeys.
Gigantopithecus.
Yes, absolutely extraordinary, extraordinary. And every hair kind of bristling.
Yeah.
It's an absolute feast for the eyes, I think, that's for sure. And it is a feast for the ears, too, because I think the voice casting is very strong, with an exception, I think, very strong across the board. Christopher Walken, who plays that character we just mentioned, who's the name of which escapes
Gigantopithecus.
Yeah, that chap is excellent. I think Bill Murray is a very inspired choice to play Baloo. He's just got that kind of lazy, lethargic thing down pat.
And he's not too silly either. I think with those sorts of characters, you sort of expect the funny friend to be there in any sort of Disney film. But there's no annoying sort of sidekick in this at all, is there? The whole film feels like you're watching a grown-up film. It doesn't have a child's film feeling about it.
Yeah, it's got a dignity to it, I think, which is in keeping with the Kipling story. I'm glad that they've gone that way, actually. It does have quite a grown-up feel to it. Ben Kingsley's very kind of relaxed and dignified performance as Bagheera as well works well. For me, the only false note is Idris Elba's Shere Khan, actually, because I think he just sounds too much like Detective Luther, basically. It's just like he's come straight out of Hackney, and he's not really giving the character enough kind of gravitas. So his first arrival just felt a little bit jarring to me.
Now, what are your thoughts on how this will go down for audiences, really separate to the comparisons with the original? Because for me, I found it was really very thrilling. I was in there for the ride all the way through. I found it like a really beautiful to watch adventure that was very touching as well. There are actually a lot of scenes here that are very peaceful. It's not just trying to keep you entertained constantly. Do you think the positive reviews that it's getting initially now, are they going to keep up and really, you know, push it across the line to be maybe one of Disney's biggest films?
I hope so. I mean, they're releasing it at a very clever time of year, I think, because you wouldn't want it to be lost in the kind of pell-mell of summer releases and the kind of Marvel comic blockbusters that we've got coming up, because those are, you know, those are designed kind of for you never to be bored for a second. They're incredibly hyperactive films. And this has a slightly more, as you say, more peaceful energy to it. So I think releasing it in April is quite wise of them. And it will hopefully be a kind of sleeper hit that will sit around for a little while. It will get sort of attention around awards time as well, I think, for the effects, of course, and for things like the music. I think it's a really rather a good effort, and Jon Favreau shows yet again that he's able to kind of veer from genre to genre with a lot of sophistication. He, you know, he's now made the Iron Man films, but also his own little chef film last year. He originally, of course, was behind Swingers, King of the Swingers, you could say. A friend of mine made that pun. He's got many strings to his bow, and I think there's a warmth to this film that really kind of will endear it to a lot of people.
Absolutely, I thoroughly enjoyed it. Well, The Jungle Book is rolling out in cinemas all around the world this month. It comes out here in the UK, the US, Canada and China, amongst others, today. And our final film today is from Japan. Our Little Sister is a new drama by Hirokazu Koreeda that follows three sisters in their 20s who haven't seen their father for 15 years. When he dies, they attend his funeral and meet a half-sister, Suzu, who they invite to live with them. Tim, this film is actually based on a manga series, isn't it?
That's right. I didn't know that until I'd seen it. It actually premiered in Cannes last year. It was in competition. The director's really a bit of a Cannes veteran. I think he's had 6 or 7 films in competition there. And they've just announced his latest film is going actually in one of the sidebars in Cannes this year. He's a very, very refined filmmaker who's very unhurried, I would say. His films tend to be quite lengthy. This one is about 2 hours, and it just has a kind of blissed out quality to it, which I found extremely rewarding and very touching. The relationships between the four young women kind of evolve over the course of various seasons. It's like you're following one season to the next, and you get quite kind of close to them, and you get kind of an intimate sense of their kind of lives as they move into adulthood. And they're very kind of generous-minded gesture towards their young half-sister who they invite to stay with them, and the various kind of relationships that get teased out over time. And their mother, in fact, comes back into the film at one point. And that's almost the only moment of real dramatic friction, because they're obviously estranged from her and have to deal with kind of some of the stuff that's gone down over the years. But otherwise, it's a film in which the characters are really trying their best to kind of be as kind of generous and kind of open-minded with each other as possible.
Well, here's a clip of the sisters inviting Suzu to come and live with them as they board their train home. Tim, just listening to some of the music there and even watching some of the clips from other parts of the film as well, it does have a sort of a classic Hollywood-esque sort of sound to it, doesn't it? Did you pick up on any sort of maybe, shall we say, American-style ways in which the story is told?
I didn't really find it to be American in its approach. It's his films are very indebted, I think, to a certain genre of Japanese cinema, which there's a name for it in Japanese which eludes me, but it's something about the kind of the film set in the home. There's a certain sort of genre that they have, which is sort of domestic drama, you might call it. Most famously, I think, made into a real commodity by Yasujirō Ozu in the 40s and 50s, and Koreeda feels like one of the filmmakers who's picked up the baton from Ozu and kind of made his own style out of it. His films are a little bit more lyrical. I think the music definitely has a sort of lilting poetry to it and accompanies scenes like there's some cycling scenes through Cherry Blossom, for instance. And he's sort of painting with light as well. I think that there's a really delicate quality to the photography in his filmmaking. He uses a lot of natural light. It's never too forced, or kind of, he's not going for any kind of big expressionist effects. It's about the poetry of daily life, essentially. And I think this was one of his best films, partly because it doesn't avoid too much forced melodrama or too much kind of clever concept-y writing. His last two films, I thought, did fall foul of that slightly. He made one called Like Father, Like Son, another one called I Wish, and they were about kind of complicated relationships between families, particularly the men in the families. And it's refreshing here that instead we actually focus on four women. They're the main characters. In fact, five, if you include the mother, who has this brief appearance. And there are other characters who come and go, but it has, yeah, the fact that it's based on a manga is remarkable. You sort of want to go and dive into that book after you've seen it, just to kind of carry on experiencing these lives along with them.
Sounds beautiful. That's Our Little Sister, which is out in the UK and Ireland today and will hit American screens in July. Well, that brings us to the end of today's show, thanks to my guest, Tim Robey. Don't forget to tune in to our weekly cinema show later on today. That's at 20:00 London time. This week, I'll be chatting to the BAFTA-winning film director, Peter Greenaway, about his new film that takes us on a journey to Mexico with the great Soviet legend, Sergei Eisenstein. You've been listening to The Monocle Arts Review with me, Ben Ryland. The show was produced by Holly Fisher. We'll be back at the same time on Monday to talk art. But for now, goodbye from me. Thanks for listening.